Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update, bispecific antibodies in the management of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with nurse practitioner Ms. Robin Klebig from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. To begin, I asked her to provide an overview of the patients she sees in the lymphoma clinic.
I think, you know, you're talking really near and dear to my heart because I started out actually in a setting where I was an oncology nurse myself, and it was a general practice. We saw everything. And I remember being a nurse feeling lucky if I even knew what the diagnosis was sometimes, let alone if it was lymphoma. I had no idea there were so many different types of lymphoma. In fact, when I came to this role at Mayo Clinic and I, you know, started in the lymphoma clinic as a nurse practitioner, I thought, oh, I'm going to be bored if all I'm seeing is lymphoma. But boy, I quickly realized there are so many different intricacies of different types. They have their own personalities in a way. You know, they present differently, respond differently. And so I really have loved being in the lymphoma clinic for the past nearly 18 years. And of course we see, you know, what the most common, you know, types of lymphoma, that being diffuse large B cell, second most common follicular. We do see a lot of that, you know, and it's interesting to see, you know, the newly diagnosed and then, you know, being a specialty center, we definitely see a lot of the relapsed refractory when maybe the community settings don't quite know what to do anymore. And maybe we've got either expertise on what the newest treatments are, or hopefully a clinical trial. And we certainly do see a lot of the less common ones, you know, maybe like mantle cell. That's one of my favorite lymphomas, actually. It's so fascinating. In addition to the Hodgkin's and, you know, marginal zones and things like that. What strikes me sometimes is I was talking one time with the physician that I used to work with in Tennessee. And, you know, I said, okay, are you going to ASH? I was going to ASH and I'm going to go to this topic on Hodgkin lymphoma because I'm really interested. And he said, oh, I'm not going to that. I maybe see, you know, three new cases a year. And I said, what? I probably see, you know, sometimes 3 to 5 patients a day with Hodgkin's. You know, not so much that it's just that there's more lymphoma in what we call the lymphoma belt in the Midwest, but we do see a lot of people from around the country and sometimes around the world. So I think between that and also even the mantle cells, it is, you know, less common. But, you know, I can see like 6 mantle cells a day as well. So it's fascinating. And what I've really enjoyed too is just seeing the difference in treatment, you know, way back then. I mean, I was treating people before we even had rituximab, and all we had was CHOP or CVP that we used to give for the lower grade lymphomas. And it's just been really fascinating to see the differences and all of the tools that we now have, and it continues to expand and blow our minds. So,
actually, that was one thing I jotted down that I wanted to ask you, because I know you've been there so like 17, 18 years, mm-hmm. and so you were there before rituximab, and I was just curious, you know, for people who've only been in oncology 5 or 10 years, they just think, oh, right, everybody with non-Hodgkin lymphoma seems like they're getting either rituximab or, you know, obinutuzumab, anti-CD20 antibody. Mm-hmm. But can you talk a little bit about what it was like when rituximab came in? It must have been, what, more than 10 years ago, right?
Yeah, I feel like it was like right around 2000 or so. So I was actually still in Tennessee at that time, and that was such a breakthrough. And I actually work, you know, Dr. Haberman is one of the people that I work with here. He, you know, was one of the pioneers in that. So we get to hear that story a lot. I mean, it was just, you know, fascinating. The other thing was my dad was actually going through lymphoma before rituximab came out. And I really wish that he would have been able to benefit from that. As with any new therapy, you know, so rituximab, you know, learning about how dangerous it was when it first came out, when we were learning, you know, what do we need to treat? You know, how do we mitigate the infusion reactions? I mean, there's definitely the risk of people dying or, you know, tumor lysis, every potential worrisome symptom that you could have. And now think of how far we've come and how comfortable we are with it. And I think that's the having the benefit of having that history when we come out now with these new treatments, and we're all nervous about when CAR T comes out or bispecifics, and oh my gosh, how am I ever going to remember this? How are we going to get these patients through it? And with time, you learn how to deal with these things and kind of mitigate the potential risks and get them through it. I think between learning how to give the drug and manage toxicities and also just the excitement of how well it works, whether single agent or in combination.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is you learn about things as you go along, and we had to take a whole new look at rituximab and other anti-CD20 therapy when the COVID pandemic came along, because it seemed like there was a thinking that maybe these agents were decreasing the ability to sort of fight off COVID.
Definitely.
And you're still, I guess that's still an issue, right?
It is. COVID and, you know, other infections as well. It's always going to be a risk with lymphoproliferative disorders and in the treatments.
I was curious about your comment that I haven't heard before. I'm even the last one to hear it. Lymphoma belt in the Midwest. Is that true?
Yes. Yes, it is. Dr. Halberman has some nice slides on that. You know, we do like an epidemiology study with affiliated with some of the other large cancer centers. And you definitely see more incidence of lymphoma. You know, there's many theories about it, whether it's related to the farm chemicals, you know, kind of, you know, following the Mississippi River. So it's not just Minnesota, but it's Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, a large data bank that we have. And there is another, you know, when they started doing this epidemiology study, we also found that there seems to be an association with vitamin D deficiency. And well, that makes sense. You know, we don't get as much sunshine up here. We don't get as much vitamin D exposure. So there's more vitamin D deficiency. And, you know, so started looking at that. And there are certain types of lymphoma that we know are associated with vitamin D deficiency. And, you know, do we do better by replacing it? Or, you know, so it opens up a lot of questions. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, you know, herbicides and risk of farming, I had heard. I guess it makes sense that the Midwest is where a lot of farming goes on.
That's
so,
right. That's right.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense. Again, before we start, you know, drilling down into specifics, I'd also like you to talk a little bit about sort of your vision for these two subtypes of non-small cell non-Hodgkin lymphoma that we're going to focus on today, follicular and diffuse large B-cell. Mm-hmm. When I say to you the word diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, like what comes to mind in terms of a classic sort of clinical scenario and thing that you might think about?
You know, we know so much more about it now. As I was saying, you know, I didn't used to understand the difference between the different subclassifications, but even with the classifications like diffuse large B-cell, we used to wonder, okay, why does this person do really well with treatment and they go into remission and never relapse? But yet this person with the same diagnosis on paper, they don't do as well. Why is that? And then we learned about the GCB phenotype and, you know, ABC. And so just learning about how do we need to treat them? What can we do with this information? And then, of course, learning about, well, actually, there's like double hit and triple hit, high-grade B-cell, you know, and we've got to treat them differently, treat them more aggressively, and they may respond better to certain regimens. So you start to get a sense for who's more likely to relapse. And I think you tend to maybe approach people differently, you know, going into there a little bit more confidently if they have, you know, just garden variety diffuse large B cell, for example. Whereas on the other side of it, you know, you kind of set people up saying, so we're going to watch you really closely and we're going to try to get you. Our hope is that you're going to make it a year or two, because we know that, you know, the majority of people, if they're going to relapse, it's going to be in that period of time. So we watch you more closely. And this is when, you know, we're going to really want to treat you aggressively if you do relapse within the first year. And that's when we'll go into, at this point in time, typically CAR T cell therapy or so.
So again, you will get more deeply into it, but I'm just going to answer my own question because I try to think about things as simply as I possibly can. And when I think about, first of all, when I think about diffuse large B-cell, I think about a situation where you may be able to cure the person with your initial therapy, and a good fraction of them, at least a third, maybe a half, with a, quote, garden variety diffuse large B-cell with chemotherapy. Now, with rituximab, and again, with rituximab came in, the cure rates went up. But then, as you say, you know, a significant fraction get cured, but then the people who don't get cured can have very aggressive downhill courses, usually treated very aggressively in the past with autologous transplant, high-dose chemo. Now we're talking about cell-based therapy, CAR-T, for example, as you mentioned, we're going to talk about bispecifics. But then on the flip side of the coin, when I think about follicular lymphoma, I think about a situation where, A, you're not likely to cure people with, you know, initial therapy, but also that not everybody even needs to be treated, that there's a subset of people, if they're not symptomatic, anything's major going on, they can be watched sometimes for years. And then if they do require treatment, depending upon, you know, the situation, might only get something like rituximab. And they're, again, they don't get cured, but they seem to have a much more indolent course. They can live for many years. They're older. They die of other reasons. I mean, it's not a benign disease, but very different kind of, at least in my mind, what I think about. Does that line up with your experience?
Absolutely. I think, you know, this is just, again, the fascinating thing about all the different faces of, even by name, somebody will have follicular lymphoma, but they do differently. You know, one patient, as you said, you get diagnosed and we might tell them, oh, we're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to watch. And that's, you know, you've got to educate the patients, like, okay, yes, you have a malignancy, but it's not hurting you. So we're not going to bother it if it's not bothering you. And, you know, sometimes you have to help teach them what are they going to tell their family and their community, because they think, what, your doctor told you that you have cancer and you're not going to do anything about it, you know. So there's a lot of education, and I think sometimes this can be one of the harder conversations to have, because when patients come to you with a diagnosis of cancer, they're ready, most of them, for you to just tell them this is what we need to do. But in this situation, many times you're bringing them into the conversation saying, well, what do you want to do? What do you feel comfortable with? We think it's going to be fine to observe you, and we'll see you back in 3 months and kind of observe what we call the tempo of disease. We'll see, is it really, you know, progressing fast, or is it just sitting there? Is it waxing and waning? Is it shrinking back? Sometimes these low-grade lymphomas do that. But the thing is, it can change over time. And that's why we do continue to follow people. So if it's somebody we're observing, at some point it may progress to the point where we need treatment. And then depending on what that presentation is, it's going to depend on what we recommend for treatment. And then, of course, with the low-grade lymphomas like follicular, there's the phenomena of it could transform into a different type of lymphoma. So I think that's a really fascinating topic.
So again, we're heading towards the topic of bispecific antibodies, super exciting topic. I mean, comparable to the introduction of rituximab. I mean, these agents really have the potential to dramatically alter, and they are already altering therapy. But again, I just want to sort of set the table of both of these diseases or cancers. Before we get to bispecifics, some of the other agents that are out there that might be considered in these kind of patients, what other types of treatments, how things have changed. And again, getting back to diffuse large B-cell, when I think about that in terms of other things, you mentioned CAR-T, which really is amazing that, again, like rituximab chemotherapy in some patients, seems like, and you know, they might be cured. They certainly go into complete remissions for a long time, you know, similar to rituximab chemotherapy. But a whole bunch of other things that have come into practice, and I think nurses are seeing all the time in the clinic, There was a change in the first-line therapy of diffuse large B-cell when the antibody-drug conjugate polatuzumab vedotin was added to initial sort of R-CHOP, replacing the O, so to speak. And they saw, you know, an incremental benefit. It wasn't, you know, curing everybody, but it looked like the patients did better. And then a bunch of other therapies in the relapse setting. I mentioned CAR-T. But also, I don't know if you've had much experience with the drug tafasitamab, which is often combined with lenalidomide. There's an antibody drug conjugate, loncastuximab, right? And then polatuzumab, which I just mentioned, was used, you know, up front. It's also been used in relapse disease with bendamustine or rituximab. Anything you want to say about some of those new developments in diffuse large B-cell and how it's affected the way we take care of both newly diagnosed and relapsed patients?
I think the first thing is it's great to have all these options. You know, when you go into a patient who's, you know, probably gone through, I mean, Polatrip and R-CHOP, they're not easy, but when they get relapsed or when they get relapsed disease, you know, the next step, you know, CAR-T can be, you know, a bit to go through. And before we even were doing CAR-T, doing the stem cell transplants. But if they've relapsed and progressed beyond that, it's so great to have all these other options. And a lot of times, oddly enough, you know, if they've been through CAR-T and stem cell transplant, they've got it in their mind that, oh, maybe I don't want any more treatment because, man, these were really tough to take. But then you get to start talking to them about, you know, actually these, even though you have relapsed refractory disease, possibly the treatments are not as harsh as like the stem cell or the earlier treatments that you've had. There'll be different side effects. And sometimes the way we choose what that next step is, like, you know, you mentioned three or four different, you know, down the road treatments. It's like, okay, what schedule makes sense for you? Do you want to take something that's oral that you don't have to come so often? You know, there are different factors that we can consider. And it's sometimes just the sequencing of how do we do it. I often say, you know, once you have a disease that is proving that it's going to be relapsing, whether it's diffuse large B-cell or follicular, we do kind of tend to leapfrog from one treatment to the next, and you have to strategically think about what side effects and what the situation is with the patient as far as maybe lab values, other comorbidities, distance from the center where they're going to be getting their treatment. And of course, always the availability of clinical trials on top of what the commercial availability is.
Right. And then again, just to sort of round it out in terms of follicular lymphoma, and I was just flashing on the fact that just last Friday, we recorded a 2-hour program with three investigators. And for 2 hours, all we talked about was relapse follicular lymphoma. I think first line therapy, follicular lymphoma, seems like it's still bendamustine rituximab in a lot of patients, sometimes just rituximab alone. I mentioned the other anti-CD20 antibody, obinutuzumab. Sometimes, you know, I think that's used in therapy. A couple other therapies that, you know, come on the last few years that seem like a lot of people are using. One is the so-called R-squared regimen, which actually was also tested as first-line therapy, but I think now used more with second-line. So that's rituximab and lenalidomide, a drug used a lot in myeloma. And then as you see in oncology all the time, these sort of targeted therapies, well, we talked about tafasitamab, anti-CD19 antibody. There's tazemetostat, an EZH2 inhibitor, and they have an assay they do on that. But I guess the big story there is a very well-tolerated option. And sometimes you see people who have kind of slowly evolving disease. They're not exploding the way the diffuse large B-cell patients are. They're often elderly people with other problems, you know, that may be someday threaten their life. But again, any thoughts about sort of the typical follicular lymphoma patient, particularly one who has relapsed disease?
It's again, I think similar to large cell, there are so many options. I would agree with you that standard of care, of course, we usually try to find a clinical trial, but standard of care is rituximab and bendamustine, and you know, really very well tolerated with durable remissions. And again, going into relapse disease, we know patients do better if they can stay in remission for, you know, 2 years or the POD24. And it is good to have a lot of options. Like I said, these are the people that, if especially if they relapse early, we know they're probably going to continue to relapse, and we're just going to have to leapfrog from one thing to the next. And we often give them, you know, some choice. And okay, do you want to, you know, be on, you know, an oral medication, you know, along with, you know, maybe some maintenance we might consider, maintenance rituximab and other things, but very, very livable. I often am talking to my patients about, you know, you'll have to come here and see me frequently, but I want to make sure that you're living your life, you know.
So. Yeah, and you mentioned an important concept. I think really clarifies a lot about follicular lymphoma, the quote POD24, which is the patient who gets initial therapy, again, usually bendamustine or rituximab, mm-hmm. and then has relapse or progression within 24 months. Mm-hmm. Which tells you that a lot of patients go many years, and then you see somebody really, if you had pancreatic cancer, it'd be very unlikely you'd go 24 months without progressing. But follicular lymphoma, very different story. Mm-hmm. Most people get the BR, then they're off therapy for, I guess, years, right?
Mm-hmm. They are. Sometimes they don't relapse. And that's, you know, patients come in and they think, oh, I've been told this is incurable. But I always say it doesn't 100% mean it's going to come back, even especially with like mantle cell as well. If people think they're going to relapse, they're not necessarily going to. So yes, we need to continue to follow you, check you out, but I want to emphasize that they have to keep living their life. You know, don't give up hope. There are still things that we can do. Our goal is to try to, you know, yes, keep them in remission, put them back in remission, but always make sure that they have, you know, quality as well.
Yeah, and also there's the concept of functional cure that we kind of got out of chronic myeloid leukemia, where you really can't cure the disease, although now maybe sometimes. But the idea is you live to the same age and die at the same age as an age match population. Mm-hmm. Without symptoms of the disease. So it's, I guess you could say in a way like diabetes, theoretically you could have a normal life expectancy and quality of life.
Very
All right,
true.
Well, with that as background, and I got to say, I mean, you know, we talked about some of the things that have come about since rituximab, but not that much. You know, it really was earth-shattering. I think CAR T and bispecific, of course, it's not just in lymphoma, myeloma, we're going to do a program as well on that. You see revolutionary changes, same thing, bispecifics and CAR T. But in terms of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, I think these are two gigantic advances that I guess we're still trying to sort out. You see still new agents coming aboard. And, you know, I know in your talk that you gave on this, you showed a picture that Matt Lunning, I love working with Matt. He always comes up with these wild metaphors and analogies. The idea of Lady and the Tramp being a concept that talks about what a bispecific is. In your mind, what is a bispecific antibody? How do you explain it to your patients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's explaining it to the patients and also, you know, to nurses and new nurse practitioners. I think in dealing with lymphoma or lymphoproliferative disorders, most people are familiar with the concept of rituximab being a CD20 monoclonal antibody. And so I kind of take them back to that concept, that that's an antibody, a CD20 antibody that's targeting a CD20 antigen or protein on the lymphoma cell. And so a bispecific antibody is just, it's got, you still have with lymphoma a CD20 antibody part, but it's also attached to like another targeting antibody that targets now the T cell, the patient's own immune cell. I often tell patients, you know, your immune system was supposed to catch this. It was supposed to surveil and take out any, you know, cancerous cells, lymphoma cells, and that sort of thing. And so what we're doing with these bispecifics is the part of the bispecific that targets the CD3, typically on your T cell, is going to bring those cells, your T cell and the lymphoma cell, into close proximity, kind of introducing your immune system to, this is what you're supposed to target. This is what you go after. I sometimes think of it too as, it's almost like those, you know, drug sniffing dogs, right? Looking for drugs. You train it to say, okay, this is what you're going after. And this is what we're doing with your immune system. Just say, okay, this is it. This is your target.
So both of these therapies, bispecifics as well as CAR T, are trying to improve immune function against the lymphoma, but, you know, pretty big difference. You know, first of all, bispecifics are off the shelf, like rituximab, for example, whereas CAR T is a much more complex process. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, again, what happens when you get a CAR T therapy, how you do that as opposed to how you do what you do when you have a bispecific?
So CAR T cell therapy is, you know, using the patient's own cells, and then they have to be sent away to be manufactured. And it can take, you know, 3 weeks or so. And some patients who, at the point that they're needing CAR T cell therapy, something drastic, they don't have 3 weeks sometimes. Their disease is progressing. I've had patients that I've seen who have died before they were able to get their therapy. So that's where it's really very nice to be able to have the option of the bispecific T cell engagers to just, you know, they're kind of like one size fits all. They're not specific to the patient, but they do the same as far as engaging the immune system. And there's no wait time, you know, for getting those cells manufactured. That does not require, you know, like bridging chemotherapy and things like that. So you can get them into the patient who's rapidly progressing to try to get some response quicker than the CAR T cell.
Right. And of course, there, when you send the patient's cells out, they're introducing, I think it's a viral vector into the T cells. Mm-hmm. And then they're, you know, I guess what that does is sort of juice up the T cells to go after the cancer, and then they give it back to the patient. But
right,
as you say, sometimes, well, it typically takes several weeks, and these patients may be progressing rapidly. Mm-hmm. In that situation with CAR T, where you have to wait the 3 weeks, you talked about so-called bridging therapy. What is done there? It's just some kind of systemic therapy to try to slow the tumor down until the CAR Ts are ready?
Yeah, typically. Now, you know, some people might not require much in the way of bridging, you know, maybe some corticosteroids and things. Other people might require other chemotherapy regimens, or some people have even, depending on the presentation, we've had, like, have them had radiation, something that will just hold them at bay until they can get the CAR T cells.
So I guess some of the bispecifics that we want to talk about today, mosunetuzumab as well as Ebco and glofitamab, can you talk about at least those three agents? Mosunetuzumab, which again I think is often used with follicular lymphoma, glofitamab, which I think is often used with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and then epcoritamab, which I think can be used with both. Can you talk, you know, a little bit about the differences between these three bispecifics, and then we'll talk about kind of where they're used in more details and with your cases, but sort of, you know, from 35,000 feet, what the difference is when you think about these three bispecifics?
Absolutely, because this is overwhelming when you're not used to working with them. And I think the thing that finally helped me was just kind of putting together a chart, you know, number one, to try to remember which drug can I use in which disease. And you know, some are IV, some are subcutaneous. And so it's, yeah, very interesting. So if we just start, we start talking about like diffuse large B cell, glofitamab is given intravenously. And the interesting thing about this bispecific is that day one of treatment is not getting the bispecific. It's actually getting obinutuzumab, you know, the CD20 monoclonal antibody. The reason for that is to try to mitigate some of the CRS. So the biggest symptoms, side effects with the bispecifics are CRS or cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity with ICANS, in addition to later things like infection risk and things. So with glofitamab, what the intent is, give the obinutuzumab, try to debulk, if you will, so that when they get the first dose of the bispecific, they shouldn't have as much CRS risk. So with each of these, the glofitamab, epcoritamab, mosunetuzumab, and others that are being studied, there's a step-up dosing. I think of it as just kind of sneaking in the dose, you know, it's almost like test doses in a way, just giving a little bit so that the body sort of gets used to it. We kind of expect that there's going to be a bit of a reaction. So we try to, and what these reactions are really is just the immune system, you know, gearing up. So with the pre-medications, we're trying to calm down the immune system in a way by giving corticosteroids, things like antihistamine, sometimes some acetaminophen to try to calm things down. Not too much, because you want to have it in the sweet spot of where the immune system is turned on, but not to the point where it's going to cause problems. So the glofitamab, getting the obinutuzumab, ramping it up slowly with a small dose on day 8, then 15, and then on for the rest of the treatment, they're going to get like a 30 milligram dose, again, with pre-medications. So speaking also about the glofitamab given intravenous, this is the one treatment that is just given for a certain duration of time. You give 12 cycles. It's given every 3 weeks, so it's about 8.5 months duration. So that's one thing to think about with that. Contrast that with epcoritamab, again, which is also used for relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell and high-grade B-cell. This is given subcutaneously, so it's just a shot under the skin. This is given on cycles of every 28 days, but the ramp-up is, it's actually, I think of it as, it's not so much longer dose-wise. You do like 3 doses of increasing, but then cycles 2 and 3 are given as still weekly doses of the full dose. Cycles 4 through 9 are given every 2 weeks, and not until you get until cycle 10, then you get to get it monthly or every 4 weeks. And the other distinction with this is that the design is this is given indefinitely. So you give it until disease progression or toxicity. And so that's a little hard to wrap one's head around. It's like, in one way, it's like, okay, this is controlling my disease, but how long is this going to go on? You know, nobody can tell. Whereas on the other side, the glofitamab, like you hit that 12th cycle, you're done. We're just going to observe you. And then mosunetuzumab given for follicular lymphoma, that's a little bit different yet. It's still got the ramp up, and it's given intravenously. We've done some clinical studies giving it subcutaneously, but the standard of care is to give it intravenously, and it can be given if you go into a CR, if you get a complete response, which is the hope and a realistic hope, you can stop after 8 cycles. Otherwise, you can have the option of going on to 17 cycles. And I think time is going to tell, both with this and also the epcoritamab, are we going to get more data, more information to say, okay, here's a safe place to stop? But I saw a patient this morning who's on epcoritamab, and he's like, you know, I don't want to be that first patient to say, okay, I'm going to stop. You know, you do that research on somebody else, and then you come and tell me. I don't want to say when I'm going to stop.
On the other hand, you know, that is a burden to keep coming in. It kind of reminds me a little bit about some of the discussions that go on in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, where you have indefinite BTK, Bruton tyrosine kinase therapy, yeah, versus short-term with, you know, obinutuzumab, venetoclax, and then people say, Or for those patients who would, you know, like to get it over with in 14 months, they would go one way. And I'm like, well, who wouldn't want to get it over with in 14 right. months? You right. know, I guess you're right. There probably are patients who get very attached to the center. But on the other hand, it seems great to be able to give them a little bit of a treatment break. I guess the other sort of global thing, looking at least at these three mm-hmm. bispecifics, you know, it's kind of interesting, particularly with mosunetuzumab versus glofitamab, that we see mosunetuzumab used more with follicular, glofitamab used more with diffuse large B-cell. And I asked, well, like, why? And part of it is because glofitamab is perceived to be maybe a little bit more effective, but also maybe a little more cytokine release, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, a little more toxicity, but then diffuse large B-cell can be a more aggressive disease. So mm-hmm. it seems like the trials went in that direction because of kind of how it plays out clinically, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, the glofitamab has a bivalent binding for CD20. So how does that play into it, you know, perhaps?
So we'll get into this a little bit more when we actually get into your patients. But before we do, just a couple more words about cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity, or ICANS, as you mentioned. And of course, I think, you know, CAR-T, it seems like CAR-T came along before bispecifics, mm-hmm. but that's when we started to hear about these two syndromes that you've already talked about, cytokine release being, you know, fever and a lot of things, hypotension. Some of these patients can go into the intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. Also, the agent tocilizumab, which is sometimes used to manage these patients. Anything else you can say about your experience with cytokine release syndrome? Sort of, you know, it seems, again, I hear mosunetuzumab, they have less of it. The patients are getting managed on the outpatient setting. Mm-hmm. Some of the other situations, maybe it's a little more difficult. Mm-hmm. But like when you think about the less difficult end of cytokine release and the more difficult, what are some of the things that come into your mind?
Mm-hmm. So with bispecifics, the cytokine release and even neurotoxicity seem to be less prevalent and less intense as we compare it to what we've seen with CAR T cell therapy. With cytokine release, usually the main symptom is going to be initially like a fever. And what we've seen with, we don't tend to see the grade 3 and 4 cytokine release syndrome with the bispecifics. And it seems to be very predictable as well. Most of, if they're going to have cytokine release, it's going to be during the ramp up, during cycle 1. Typically, when they get to cycle 2 and beyond, it's not typically seen, less of a concern. Even with some of the step up dosing, there are recommendations that the patients are admitted to the hospital for observation, you know, with certain step-up doses. At our center, we actually have like an outpatient hospital-based center where they are monitored closely and observed for a couple of days until they get past that point. So they don't actually have to be admitted unless they exhibit like a fever, which is going to be like the hallmark of cytokine release syndrome. So it's definitely very manageable. And one of the things that we do see, you know, in talking about that patient or any of the patients who, gosh, you know, they're traveling here from a distance, once they get beyond a certain point, it's safer to be able to get their treatments out in the community when the risk for these major side effects of CRS and neurotoxicity are pretty much, you know, just very minimal risk at that point.
Yeah, these experts we had at this roundtable on follicular lymphoma, I was saying, well, do you think a general medical oncology clinic in the community can start a patient with FL on mosunetuzumab, which is something I think they would never even thought about. Most oncologists haven't even done that. Mm-hmm. And they all were like, yes. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was pretty encouraging. Why don't we hear about, this is kind of interesting, it's a 52-year-old man diagnosed age 48. That's pretty young, I guess, mm-hmm. for follicular lymphoma. What happened with him?
Oh, well, one of the things I pointed out on him is that his mother had the same type of lymphoma. And so he almost, when he was diagnosed, he almost was like, yep, I knew it was going to happen, you know. And then he just kind of knew, you know, going into it that I'm going to relapse, and he fully expects to die from this, which can be a little bit disheartening sometimes, especially if he's responding well, right? We're going in all excited. Hey, your PET scan's great. And he's like, yeah, it is now, you know? So,
you know, I guess we should interject that this is very unusual. It's not a typical patient with FL. A typical patient would be older without any family history. I don't even remember hearing about a case like this, but but either way, he's got follicular lymphoma and looks like he got the typical, at least initial treatment of bendamustine rituximab. Was that when you were taking care of him, or that was before?
Yeah. So I've known him since the beginning, and this is very unusual. Normally people could get diagnosed with follicular, but given BR, they go into remission, they're good for a few years, right? This guy was getting BR, progressed on it. So we knew something is off. He, you know, we always will repeat a biopsy if there's any concern. But with him, we were like so sure. But every time we biopsied it, yep, low-grade follicular, so okay. But because it was so aggressive behaving, he did actually go ahead and get R-CHOP. And again, relapsed less than a year later. That's not a good sign. Went ahead, you know, we said, okay, this is a guy back at that time. This is a guy we're going to want to transplant. So we send him up for, salvage therapy with rice. He didn't respond to that. Couldn't even get him to transplant. And that's when he went ahead and had CAR T cell therapy. And he had, again, a great response. He had a DOVL 1 at day 30, but unfortunately on day 90, he had progression. So then Then he went on a clinical trial, and he did okay. I think he achieved maybe a DOVL 3, which technically is negative, but we all feel better if it's a 1 or a 2. And then he finally progressed after a little over a year on that therapy. Then again, he came in and he's like, maybe it's just time for me to be done, and I'm just going to go on hospice or something. And at that time, we're like, well, not so fast. We've got some other things we can consider, and you know, we're actually feeling pretty optimistic about it. And if you're up for it, we'll try this new therapy called bispecific. And so he was started on that. And
before you kind of get into what happened, just to clarify a couple of things.
Yeah,
you referred a couple of times to DOVL 1 or 3. What's the meaning of that?
Absolutely. Sorry about that. It's I always say it's the way the radiologist grades the response on PET CT. So the hypermetabolic activity, and they measure it according to the activity in the liver and the mediastinal blood pool. So they have kind of a baseline, and if anything is at or below that level, then it's normal activity. Because if you look at a PET scan, there are areas in our body that are going to show hypermetabolic glucose activity, like our brain, kidneys, bladder, bowel will have some physiologic activity. Sometimes you'll see some cardiac activity. But if there's anything above what is like that threshold of the liver and the mediastinal blood pool, then it's abnormal. And so the DOVL score goes from 1 to 5. A 5 would mean that's new disease or progressive disease. A 4 would mean, you're responding to treatment, but there's still obviously some active disease. Anything from a 3, 2, or 1 are considered negative, kind of varying on how much activity there is, which can be just inflammation or even treatment effect inflammation. So if it's a DOVL 3, it's considered negative. But like I said, we always feel better when it's a 2 and definitely a 1. We feel like, okay, this is a clean scan, you know. So that's kind of the goal for everybody.
So just to summarize where this patient was when he went on, I guess it was a trial of a bispecific, or was it actually approved at that point?
Of the bispecific?
Of the mosunetuzumab.
Yeah, he's not on a clinical trial for that. He's taking it commercially.
He actually got it as being part of the people who got it once it got approved. But before we get to that, just to summarize, He had three different types of rituximab and chemotherapy, went through all that. Mm-hmm. CAR T, which we thought was so great, he went right through that. Mm-hmm. We talked about R squared as a second line therapy. He got that plus some kind of vaccine and a trial, mm-hmm. went through that as well. Mm-hmm. And I can understand where at that point. And also, as you were saying, it looks like he's got a lot of disease on his scan, particularly in his abdomen.
Absolutely. That was his initial scan. So luckily, I mean, at that point, obviously he was sick, just figuring out what his diagnosis was. Luckily, on subsequent scans, you know, again, we're watching him closely. He didn't get that sick again, but he still would have symptoms. He would have like abdominal pain, sometimes some night sweats and things like that.
So, yeah, we have an incredible scan that shows on June 2024 with a Dovel 5, which you just heard Robin describe. Mm-hmm. And then October, so 4 months later, now it's a Dovel 1 that you just described. And I guess this was the result of mosunetuzumab. What happened mm-hmm. to him clinically when he got the mosunetuzumab? Did he have any tolerability, side effects, cytokine release? What happened to mm-hmm. his tumor? What's going on with him now?
Yeah, he did have some cytokine release, and but it was well managed. And we kept him up with like corticosteroids and diphenhydramine and Tylenol. You know, with this, if you don't have if you tolerate some doses, if you tolerate subsequent doses, you have the option of holding off on treatment. But I think he had one treatment where he didn't get any pre-medications and he ended up having flu-like symptoms. This was, I think, when he got to maybe cycle 3 or something, but he was having flu-like symptoms. So all of his treatments subsequently, he just gets a little acetaminophen and diphenhydramine and he tolerates it much better. So he's actually feeling really well now. Once we got past those flu-like symptoms, his energy level is better. I think he's allowing himself to live his life, so to speak. You know, he was kind of at a point where he was ready to just quit. But again, me and I think other people here, we just say, okay, you got to keep living your life. Plan a vacation. Go on vacation. You know, you've got some weeks between here. His daughter had gotten married, I think, right before we started. That's kind of the likely story. This is the age group where life events are happening and they want to be around for it. And but this is the classic, as I was mentioning earlier, it's like, how do we know how long to keep this up? So he's been in a complete response since after 3 cycles. Our goal is to at least get him 8. Well, then do we stop there because he's in a CR? Or we've seen his history. He's relapsed all the time. Should we keep going? That's a big discussion about what to do. And, you know, it kind of raises the question that we're doing in some disease types like mantle cell. What about checking MRD status? How can that help guide therapy? It might not be what you want to get into today, but it is kind of something that people are talking about.
Yeah, no, I mean, we hear that all throughout oncology, solid tumor oncology as well, looking for, you know, subclinical. Mm-hmm. So people have normal scans, but you can find evidence. You know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of PSA, although it's, you know, very different technology, but detecting the tumor systemically when there's nothing on imaging. And I know that's being looked at in almost, it seems like every type of cancer, they're looking at that. Mm-hmm. Just for situations like this, maybe if he was MRD negative, you feel better about stopping. Mm-hmm. So to be continued. I was just flashing on the fact last week, I do these meetings every now and then, or a couple times a year for our company, including everybody, the people in the financial department, et cetera. And I was showing them I love to do these programs with nurses where we ask, how often do people ask you, well, why are you in oncology? Isn't it depressing? And one of the reasons I think people stay in it is cases like this. Can you imagine? Here's a person who's kind of expecting to go to hospital who's now in complete remission, mm-hmm. on a pretty non-toxic therapy, too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I imagine you must feel pretty good when he walks into clinic.
I do. It's a good day.
All right, let's go into your next case. Again, a different sort of flavor here because now we're talking about diffuse large B-cell, 64-year-old woman. What happened with her?
So she had an aggressive disease. She was 62 when she was diagnosed, had actually involvement in her neck, and actually it was involving her brachial plexus. So she was having a lot of pain with this. So she had R-CHOP, and she did go into remission. But again, one of these sad stories where we know it's bad if you relapse within the first year, she relapsed within 6 months. So she then really standard of care at that point would go ahead and go to CAR-T. She did well, achieved the DOVL 1 at day 30, was still in remission at day 90. But then 10 months later, she again had relapse in her chest, and that right brachial plexus was giving her a lot of pain that she required palliative radiation. So because there was some like neurological involvement, she had this very aggressive regimen called Matrix, which I think I've only seen a couple of times. Very difficult to tolerate, had to have dose reductions, but somehow she got through 3 cycles and achieved a response, was able to go to an auto stem cell transplant. But after all that, she progressed on day 100. So how, you know, frustrating. You can been through all that. And, you know, again, we've got a bispecific we can try. So she was given glofitamab in the usual fashion, giving her the obinutuzumab and then ramping up into that. And symptomatically, we could, you know, she could tell. And this is one of those situations I'd say, you're going to know before we know. And actually she had, so she was having symptoms like fatigue and night sweats. Even if you look at her scan, she didn't have a lot of disease. There was a couple of spots there in her liver. And then after a couple of doses, she had a repeat scan, which showed improvement, but you can still see that there was a little bit of a spot medially in her liver, but enough that we would continue on with treatment. So then after 5 cycles, we repeated her PET scan. The liver lesion, which was really the only site of disease, that had resolved. So if that would have been all we saw, we'd say, great, you've had a complete response. But here's these new areas in her lung and in her, you know, chest, in her lymph nodes. Well, crap, what's that? So as always, whenever we see something new, it's like we're going to biopsy it and then try to decide what to do. Well, thankfully and surprisingly, it turned out not to be lymphoma or malignancy, but it was consistent with histoplasmosis. So, I mean, that was just amazing. So now she's on treatment for histoplasmosis, continuing on the glofitamab. She just completed the 6th cycle, and the plan is going to be, and then again, she's getting this locally at this point. She just comes back to our center to have her imaging. But yeah, and now she's, you can see I put there a note, she wants hip surgery. So it's like the lymphoma is it's on the back burner. It's like, now I want to be active. I want to walk. I want to do all these things. So I want to get my hip replaced. And it's just fun to see how their priorities shift and what they need done.
I'm still thinking about, isn't oncology depressing, and imagining the day that you got back the biopsy report expecting it to be lymphoma and seeing it's histoplasmosis. I can imagine that must have been a great relief to you, the patient, or family, and what an incredible story.
It was, and it was right around Christmas too, so it was perfect.
Wow. Wow. Love it.
Yeah.
So what happened with this 64-year-old man, high-grade B-cell lymphoma, gets epcoritamab, the other approved bispecific that we talked about.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad we had time to talk about him. I think I say this a lot. He's one of my favorite patients. I have a lot of favorite patients, but this is this is one of my favorite stories. So he was diagnosed and treated initially at an outside facility. So he was diagnosed called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Again, GCB subtype, a double expressor, had R-CHOP, it went into remission, but 10 months later he had, you know, some kind of recurrent disease. So he had a biopsy that at that point showed it was high-grade B-cell. So he had, it was a double hit. It was a MYC and BCL2 rearrangements. So at that point, then he came to see us, and he went on a clinical trial that we had here with using salvage treatment with rice and lenalidomide. Did go into remission, had a stem cell transplant. And unfortunately, he had prolonged cytopenias, so he just wouldn't recover. And briefly, he was diagnosed with a therapy-related CCUS, clonal cytopenia of undetermined significance. So, okay, well, we'll just watch him. He went and saw our myeloid group, and he's being observed. Should they consider doing, you know, transplant and that for that disease? He was being observed. So, okay. A couple of years later, though, he has relapse of his lymphoma, now in his liver. And so there'll be a picture of that. But, you know, normally at that point, you might think, okay, well, should we do CAR T cell therapy? But because of his CCUS, because of his pancytopenia, we did not want to damage his bone marrow anymore by giving him, you know, the lymphodepleting chemotherapy and, reduction chemotherapy. So, okay, the thing that we might try was let's try a bispecific. It should be, even though there are risks of cytopenia, it's much less than the lymphodepleting chemotherapy. So this guy is so, he's such a funny guy. And he's like, I want to know how big is that? And I would show him his pictures and I would say, okay, think of it like a grapefruit. You've got like a grapefruit sized tumor in your liver. Okay. He's like, okay. Yeah, I can visualize that. So then he had, you know, several doses and he could tell after a few doses that clinically he was feeling better. And then after three doses, we had another scan. I went into the room. And he's like, okay, how does the scan look? And I said, you have the cutest little tumor. And he said, well, how big is it? It was like a grapefruit before. What is it now? And I said, well, it's kind of between a blueberry and a raspberry. He's like, oh, okay, I can visualize that, you know? And so kept going with treatment. And then after nine doses, we did it again. Then he had a Deauville 3. So again, getting smaller, you can still see the lesion. And then that was back in October. And then more recently, last month, he had another one. And again, he's always like, okay, how big is it now? How big is it now? And I said, I think you're going to be disappointed, but I can't even see it. I can't tell you what kind of fruit or food this is. He's like, you know, so it was really, really cool. So he had a huge, huge tumor, continues on therapy. And now just like the last lady, he's like, what he wants now is to get his knee surgery because this guy has terrible knees. But despite that, it doesn't keep him from walking like 8 miles a day. Wow. So he wants to get his knees fixed. He's like, okay, you know. We can make sure your blood counts are okay. You can get them fixed. So,
imagine a lot of people listening to this are thinking like I was. What I'd be thinking if somebody told me I had something the size of a grapefruit in my liver. But great ending to that story. And let's finish out with your other patient here. Another patient who got, I guess we call it EBCO, 62-year-old man. What happened with him? Yeah. He's had transformed disease. What happened there?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. So transformed means like we talked briefly earlier, you have like a low-grade lymphoma and it can transform. It can turn into a more like a higher grade, like a diffuse large B cell. Sometimes though, it's not sequential. It's not like you always have to have low grade for a number of years, and then all of a sudden it'll change. But sometimes they occur simultaneously, and we call that a composite lymphoma. His initial scan, you can see the variety of colors on that abdominal mass that he had. This is, again, why it's so important to target the appropriate areas for biopsy, because initially they targeted a right inguinal lymph node that showed low-grade lymphoma, but not until they targeted that hot spot in the abdomen did they see, oh, he actually has just a bit of diffuse large B cell in there, in addition to grade 3A follicular and grade 1-2 follicular. So just a gamish of lymphoma in there. But again, very aggressive. So he went on to treatment with R-CHOP and again relapsed at 12 months. And it was kind of a higher grade follicular, went to salvage therapy with rice, had a transplant 9 months later, had low grade lymphoma in the left pelvis. And he would relapse in the weirdest places. You can see after he had radiation to the left pelvis, he had this thing in the periumbilical area. And we thought, well, that's really strange. Well, biopsied it and it showed a B-cell lymphoma follicle center origin with extensive crush artifact. I don't know about you, but I don't like seeing extensive crush artifact. That's just, there's something going on there. And So he actually went on to CAR T cell therapy 8 months later. Again, a weird place. Seminal vesicles, what a weird place to, to relapse. I know. And again, it was the biopsy showed follicle center B cell with crush artifact concerning for aggressive lymphoma. So of course we're going to treat it. You know, he basically had a transformed high-grade component. And so he was started on epcoritamab. And again, the story, didn't want to start treatment until his youngest daughter got married and was able to start and had a couple of cycles. And he's actually the guy that I saw just a few hours ago this morning. Now he's completed three cycles of treatment and he's getting his treatment locally. So he had significant response getting his treatment locally. And he's the one that said to me this morning, I'm just going to keep taking it until somebody else proves to me that I can quit, because he's had such a history. But yeah.
When he had this seminal vesicle thing, did he feel it, or could you feel it?
No. A lot of his subsequent lymphomas after his initial presentation were asymptomatic. So even, you know, you can imagine when he had that periumbilical soft tissue, I saw him that day. And for a while, I think every time he would come in and have bad news, I was the one that would see him. You know, sometimes, you know, we have a big center, you know, sometimes they'll see different providers, but I was always the one that was breaking the news to him, it seemed, you know. So, no, he didn't have symptoms.
So just a couple more things. One, something that probably occurs to anybody who's looking at these cases, and something I see hotly debated, I don't know if there's any consensus about this, which is, you know, several of your patients got both of these new types of immune therapy, CAR T as well as bispecifics. Seems like most of the ones you presented, they got the CAR T first and bispecific after. I've heard cases where it was reversed. They got bispecific first, CAR T after. I hear people debating about it that, you know, like diffuse large B cell, maybe they want to get the CAR T first because it maybe a cure rate. Follicular lymphoma, maybe they want to go bispecific first because it's an indolent disease, it's less toxic. But does that come into the discussion when you have somebody who's never gotten either a bispecific or CAR T and they might be eligible to receive both? You know, CAR T now, certainly older people can get it and those with comorbidities in many situations. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about this issue? What should come first?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely you're absolutely right. You have to take it on the individual basis. For example, the patient with the grapefruit-sized tumor, we might have gone to CAR T, but he couldn't because of his comorbidity with the bone marrow disease and his low counts and things. I think I saw, you know, recently that discussion about, well, if you have a higher potential cure rate or CR rate with CAR T. I think that was Nancy Bartlett had at least an abstract, maybe a paper recently that indicated that. But it's again, it's you have to go with whatever the patient, what their individual picture looks like.
I guess also we should say that, you know, as always is the case in oncology, usually when new treatments come in, they start with people who've already had all the available treatments. And then as time goes on, we get more experience, that particularly if they're not so toxic, we start thinking about using them earlier. And I think in terms of lymphoma, at least bispecifics, I know there are trials that actually incorporate bispecifics as part of initial treatment of lymphoma, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, particularly FL and diffuse large B cell. So maybe in the future, we'll actually see this as part of initial therapy, depending upon how these trials sort of play out. I guess the final question I wanted to just put out to you is any sort of nursing pearls about bispecifics, things that, you know, if you were talking to somebody who'd never had a patient who got a bispecific, anything in particular you might want to sort of highlight for them?
You know, I think it's going to depend on where they're working. I'm going to assume that we're talking about the nurses who are giving the treatment, because we have nurses who do our education, we have nurses who are helping with us with follow-up, but for the nurses who are actually doing the administration of it, just kind of, you know, being aware of you know, like some guidelines of what do you need to know? What are the things that are going to happen? You almost expect that you're going to maybe see some early CRS, just, you know, and, you know, giving that, you know, giving the pre-medications and things, but also having at the ready, whether it's NCCN guidelines or the ASCTC guidelines, of knowing how do you grade it? How do you recognize what's going on, grading it? And that will help to set your path as far as what needs to be done as far as the treatment.
I think a lot of people heard about all these different grading systems when CAR T came in, and you know, maybe we didn't have to look at it that much because CAR T was being mainly used in tertiary centers. But now we talk about bispecific. Like I say, I mean, I think at this point they are actually getting started in community-based settings. So it's here. I think the other thing is that, you know, sometimes when you see new therapies coming in, honestly, maybe they're really not that much of a difference to patients. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit better, but not that much. But these seem to really have a great opportunity at relatively low costs, I would say, in terms of toxicity globally. When you think about all the different cancer therapies, that this is really an exciting thing. I think if you could get on a trial using it earlier, I'd be wanting to do that because it looks like it has a lot of advantages.
Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, you know, think about when we first started using rituximab. We were all nervous about it, but you know, I'm already seeing, you know, so much more relaxed atmosphere about giving, whether it's CAR T or bispecifics, you know, so you just have to do it a few times and you feel much more comfortable.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Ms. Kliebig, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update.